Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm here with Dr. Laura Crucianelli. She currently works as a postdoctoral researcher in Henrik Ehrson's lab at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. Dr. Crucianelli completed her PhD at the Department of Psychology at the University of Hertfordshire and in collaboration with the University College London under the supervision of Dr. Paul Jenkinson and Dr. Katharina Fotopoulou. Her PhD project investigated affective touch, sense of body ownership, and interoceptive awareness in both healthy and clinical population. So, Dr. Crucianelli, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, great. So, since I've already had another guest on the show, Dr. Sarah Garfinkel, with whom I talked about interoception, let me just ask you very quickly, could you give us a short, succinct definition of interoception, just before we move on to the next questions?
Yes, sure. Yeah, I think it's important also because there is a big debate about what is the best definition of interoceptions, depending a bit on what we're focusing on. So there is the traditional definition of the body-to-brain axis of sensations about the internal states of the body and the visceral organs. However, I'm much more keen to adopt the definitions by Craig, which extended a bit the field of interception following physiological and anatomical evidence to also include skin-mediated sensations, so such as like temperature, pain, and affective touch. And I think this makes sense if we think that interception can be considered as the physiological status of the entire body at any given time. So this is a bit the definitions they are more close to.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned affective touch. Since that's one of the topics that you've already explored in your work, could you tell us a little bit more what that specifically is about?
Yes, of course. So affective touch is a specific kind of touch which is delivered at velocities between 1 and 10 centimeters per second. So macroneurography study found that when touch is delivered at these velocities, there is an optimal activation of a specific type of skin fibers, which is called the CT afferent system. And what is very interesting is this, the more this system is activated, and the higher is the pleasant percept that the participants experience. So there is really a linear correlation between the activation of these fibers on the skin and the pleasant sensation. Mm-hmm. So what is very interesting is that this this system from the skin, it seems to take a separate pathway to the brain, and it seems to activate the posterior insula rather than the somatosensory cortex. And we know that the insula is an area that is really, really important for our sense of body ownership. And this is why also affective touch has been redefined as an interoceptive modality, because it seems to share much more characteristics with interoceptive signals rather than classic exteroceptive signals. So it does not come as a surprise, the idea that we have this specific system for the detection of affective touch, which is also very important, which is very important for the way we build social relationship with others, because it's very important for us that we perceive this kind of slow, caress-like touch as pleasant. It's very, you know, it provides a motivation to seek this kind of touch. But we also found that it's very important for the way we become aware of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And what is the sense of body ownership, and how does it relate to something like interoceptive awareness or interoception in general?
So the sense of body ownership is quite literally the awareness of ourselves, of our body, and of ourselves as embodied being. And as I mentioned, we discovered the affective touch is really important for this process of becoming aware of our body. And we know that in order to create a coherent sense of our body, we do need to integrate signals coming from outside our body, so the classic exteroceptive senses like vision, audition, with proprioceptions, which are informations about the position of our body, and interoception, which are these internal signals that we mentioned. So only if there is like a balanced integration of these different modalities, we are able to create a coherent and healthy sense of our body.
Mm-hmm. And why do we need to have this sense of body ownership? I mean, is it the case that people that lack it in some way have some sort of dysfunction or something like that, or not?
Well, this sense of body ownership is very important for our body awareness, so the awareness of ourselves, also, you know, it's important to create this sense of body ownership in the context of an external environment. And only if we have a proper sense of awareness of ourselves, we are also able to relate with other people. So I think it's very important for the way we relate with other people, because if I'm aware that this is my body, then I'm also aware that your body is not my body, and then we can find a common ground to interact.
Mm-hmm. And what can we learn from things that are done in experimental psychology, like, for example, the rubber hand illusion? And first of all, is it the case that the result... So before I get into what I want to ask specifically, could you tell us what is the rubber hand illusion and the kinds of results that we can get and what we can learn from that?
Yes, of course. So the rubber hand illusion is probably the most famous body illusion, and is a bit is the tool that we use in the lab to study the sense of body ownership. So during the rubber hand illusion, we place the participant's hand out of view, so you cannot see it anymore, and we place a rubber hand in front of the participant. And after a few minutes, actually seconds, of synchronous stroking between the participant's hand, which is out of view, and the rubber hand, most of the people, they experience the illusion that the rubber hand becomes their own hand. So as we say, there is this embodiment of the rubber hand. And this rubber hand illusion is the result of an interplay between vision, touch, and proprioception. So all these factors play a very important role. And let's say it's a very nice way to play a little bit around with the sense of body ownership, and it's quite reliable and well-established illusion.
So it's reliable and well-established. I'm only trying to ask you about that because I think, I'm not sure, but I think that recently I read that some of the results that came from experiments using the rubber hand illusion, I mean, they were being questioned, so is that right or not?
So when I say reliable and well-established, I mean that since the illusion has been firstly discovered in 1998, there have been Casilino of studying replicating exactly the same effect. So in that sense, I think it's scientifically, we can say it's reliable and established. I'm aware of this recent debate, and it's mainly, I think the debate is mainly around the way in which we measure it. So the outcome measure of the illusion that can be, you know, you can ask the participants, did you feel like it was your hand? Or you can actually measure the perceived location of their body after the illusion. So the debate is more around like, what is the actual measure? What we should actually measure after the illusion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand. And do the psychological effects of the rubber hand illusion change depending on the type of touch that is applied, or not?
Yes. So there are a series of constraints that we call constraints of the illusion. So the illusion will happen under certain circumstances. So for example, we know that it works just with a hand, so we have to have a humanoid shape, so it doesn't work, for example, with a wooden block. It doesn't work if the hand is rotated. And another thing that we found that is really, really important is the type of touch that you apply. So in particular, we found that if you induce the illusion using slow affective touch velocities, then there is an increase in the experience of the embodiment towards the rubber hand compared to when you use fast velocity. So that's why we said that velocity matters in this illusion, and we were also happy that other labs independently replicate the same findings.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so moving on to another topic now, we've already touched on self-awareness, right? What is minimal self-awareness about, and what do we know about its development in infants, children, and so on?
Yes. So I'm not a developmentalist psychologist, just to clarify, but because I've been very interested in affective touch and the sense of body ownership, so it came quite natural to also be interested in the way we develop, during our life, this sense of body ownership. Are we born with this, or does it need to develop throughout? So with minimal self-awareness, we mean really the first type of awareness that we experience. And since we are first of all body within a body, so we are before we're born, and there are many studies showing that we are able to perceive from inside the womb, and there are also studies showing that the way in which we perceive, for example, touch when we are inside the womb is through the tactile system rather than other tactile system that seems to develop only after birth. So in this sense, I think that tactile interactions and the way we experience touch is really a foundation for our awareness.
Mm-hmm. And okay, so going back a little bit, how is it that we can communicate accurately emotions by touch? I mean, what has to happen in the body for us to be able to interpret a specific kind of touch, for example, as one type of emotion or the other?
Yes. So we are social animals by definition, and we always find a way to interact with others. And we can say that touch is a very powerful mean of nonverbal communication. And we can talk about the reason why this is it. For example, the fact that touch is the first sense to develop ontogenetically and is mediated by the skin, which is our widest organ in terms of dimension and function. So we constantly touch ourselves and constantly touched by others. And what is very interesting about touch is also that it's a proximal and reciprocal sense. So I can look at someone without being looked in turn, but I cannot touch anyone without being touched in turn. So it's the only reciprocal sense that we really have. And there were some studies by Hartenstein, 2006 and 2009, showing that as humans, we are really, really good in reading emotions through touch and in communicate emotions through touch. We did a study a few years ago in which we wanted to also include a bit this the affective touch aspects in the communication, and we sort of replicate the finding showing that when we tend to use slow touch, the other person kind of understand that we want to communicate love and intimacy to the other person, and the results were also quite reliable. So we are really, really good in communicating emotion through touch, and we think that evolutionally, this must have a meaning, the fact that we have this specialized system which is really able to pick out this range of velocities, which is likely to have an emotional meaning.
Mm-hmm. And so there are certain conditions, certain health conditions where affective touch is affected in some way or another, right? I mean, some conditions where affective touch doesn't work exactly as it does in healthy patients or healthy people, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that in many psychiatric conditions, there is a distorted perception of affective touch in particular. And during my PhD and previous postdoc, we worked a lot with patients with anorexia nervosa. And the reason why we became very interested about it is because since we have found that affective touch is really important for the way we build our sense of body ownership and body representation, we really wanted to investigate this modality on a clinical population which presents body image distortions and lack of awareness, such as anorexia nervosa. So we ran now two experiments in which we found that people who suffer from anorexia nervosa, they tend to perceive slow caries-like touch as less pleasant compared to healthy controls. And this initially we thought that this distortion was specific for the CT optimal touch, but then in a second study that we ran, we realized that they actually perceive any kind of touch really a bit like less pleasant. And of course, we don't know if this is a cause or a consequence of the disorder, because I mean, obviously, they also have a lot of impairments in social relationships, so they don't really like to spend time with other people, and therefore they could be less exposed to touch. But we know that they definitely don't perceive the touch that usually people think as pleasant.
Mm-hmm. So, and you're still not sure if that's one of the causes of the disease or if it's one of the effects. Right.
Yeah, it's very difficult to disentangle, but we in the second study that we ran, we also investigated the perception of affective touch on people who have recovered from anorexia nervosa to see if, you know, after they start to eat again and the body kind of readjusts a little bit, whether this perception improved or not. However, we found that even after at least a year of recovery from anorexia nervosa, these people tend to perceive touch as less pleasant. So as such, it sounds like it might be more a trait, rather what we call a trait rather than a state. So it means something that seems to be independent, for example, to the malnutrition that is associated with the disorder. But I think more studies are needed to understand what could be the role of a social touch in the origin of the disorder.
Mm-hmm. And are there any other kinds of psychiatric conditions or other types of diseases that people usually tend to associate with some sort of problem in terms of interoception or affective touch more specifically?
So I haven't done work myself on it, but I'm aware of work done with the autism spectrum disorder showing that they have different perception of affective touch. And another study that we have done with patients with following right hemisphere stroke, we did find that they tend to perceive touch as less pleasant, and these seem to be associated to lesions in the insula, which is the area that I mentioned before, which seems to respond to the C-tactile system. So also in this case, there is a reduced perception of the pleasantness from touch.
Mm-hmm. And so what are the kinds of topics that you're interested in at the moment? Because I guess that we already talked here about much of the work you've done during your PhD, but what are you exploring now in the domain of interoception and other related topics?
Yes, so this indeed was the work that I done during my PhD and postdoc when I was in London with the Caterina Fotopoulou Lab. So at the moment, I'm still very interested in interoception, and I'm also very interested in multisensory integration, which is the way in which we are able to merge two senses together, basically. So my work is going a lot on this direction, but of course nothing is published just yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what you're trying to understand now is how basically we integrate information from the different senses in our brains, right?
Exactly, yes. And also, I'm also taking the time to train myself in neuroimaging, which is something that I haven't done, which is missing a bit in my CV, let's say. So I'm also taking a lot of time to learn, which is good.
And would you have some sort of long-term goal? That is, is there some big question that you would like to answer when it comes to interoception? I mean, since you're studying now multisensory integration, let's say, would you like to answer some big question about how we work or we function as embodied beings or something like that?
Yeah, well, there are many questions actually, but maybe the first one that comes to my mind is a bit to join forces in standardize a bit better the field of interoception, because you might have heard from Sarah that Sarah Garfinkel that now mainly most of the research in interoception has focused on the heartbeat counting task, so in cardiac awareness, and this task of course is great, and he provided a lot of information from what we know about interoception, but there is really a joint effort in trying to find new measures to quantify the interoception, which is a bit what we tried to do in my previous lab with affective touch. So to try to standardize new tasks to quantify interceptions, just to help the field to advance.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and since we talked about some psychiatric conditions, let me just ask you two more questions. So, do you think that in the future, work like yours and other people, and from other people that work with interoception, could help have a better understanding of how certain psychiatric conditions like anorexia nervosa and others develop?
Yes, definitely. I think we are. We're making our contributions. Sarah might have talked about treatment that actually been she might be working on in terms also interoceptive trials with people who suffer from people with autism spectrum disorder or anxiety. And I think in this sense, since the way in which we perceive our internal signals are so important for our survival, for our homeostatic regulation, for our emotional experience, for our body awareness, I think that so far this aspect has been a bit ignored, and from the scientific study of psychiatric conditions. So I think it's really important to, as a field, to give more importance and more attention to studying interoception, because for example, in the case of anorexia nervosa, what we see is that there is an imbalancement in the, when I say before that in order to create a sense of body ownership and to create a coherent sense of ourselves, we do need to integrate interception, exteroceptions, and proprioception. And what we see in interception, in anorexia nervosa, is that there is an imbalancement in the way they integrate this information, in the sense that they tend to pay a lot of attention to external signals, and they tend to suppress interoceptive internal signals. So I think that we can think in the future to maybe, create trials in which we invite them to pay a bit more attention to the internal sensations, and who knows, maybe it's going to also help them to connect more with themselves and with their body.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so my last question will be, do you think that with that knowledge that we will have somewhere in the future about how interoception works in different clinical populations, that clinicians like psychiatrists could also improve their practice in some way? I mean, do you think that it would be possible that eventually we would develop some sort of new diagnostic tools or therapeutic approaches or something like that?
Yeah, I think it's what everybody hopes. He hopes that we can create new tools to not only new diagnostic tool, but also to prevent. So if we are able to target population that are at risk of developing a psychiatric disorder, and maybe through interoceptive tools we're able to understand this well in advance, then we might be able to act promptly to stop to at least reduce the development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so Dr. Crucianelli, let's send the interview here. Just before we go, would you like to tell people what would be some of the best places on the internet for them to find your work, the one that we've been talking about?
Well, most of the work we talk about, I think all actually, is published in a scientific journal. So I think the best way to find it is PubMed or Google Scholar. I'm quite active on Twitter, so and I usually tweet about my research, and also I have a ResearchGate profile in which most of the time people are able to download the papers, and I'm always available to be contacted over email if anyone wants to ask me any questions more specifically.
Okay, so Dr. Crucianelli, thank you again for taking the time to come on the show. I will be leaving links to your work in the description box of the interview so that people can go and check it out because it's very interesting. And it was really fun to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you're new to the channel or to the show, as you might have noticed, I've started it in February 2018 and have been putting out regular interviews with top academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields. But to keep the channel sustainable and to keep doing it in the long run, I would really like to ask you to please consider making a pledge on Patreon or PayPal, or you can also make a one-time or several times donations on PayPal as well. All of the links are in the description box of the interview and of all my other videos. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Per Erga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunda, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, David Diaz, Anian Kata, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollacy, Enrique Alenius, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Dr. Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Boss, Bo Weingart, Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein, Dan Demetriou, Robert Windegger, Rui Nácio, Arthur Coe, Marco Neves, Max Belby, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Yugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Omari Hickson, Fergal Cusson, Yevan Bodrenko, Hall Herzog, Nuno Machado, Don Ross, João Alves da Silva, Jonathan Librand, Oslem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Eira, and a special thanks to my producers, Izar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stafiniak, Dr. Ian Gilligan, Sergio Codriano, Luis Caetano, Matthew Lavender, Tom Van Egdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, and Vega Gidi, and my executive producers, Michel Ruzieski, Rosie, and James Pratt. Thank you for all.